Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 177, Stunning the Mind with Yoga.
This painting is the Medicine Buddha, and over there is a mandala, what they call a powder, color particle, initiatory mandala of the Medicine Buddha mandala. And so the thing is, when you're here, you have to feel well all the time and be happy. That's the spirit of Menla. You have to, the minute you step on this property, you have to be really happy. And or if you're miserable, you have to enjoy being miserable. And that's what I do. and we're very delighted to have Richard, free man, and Mary, free woman, here again for the Buddha and the Yogis event. And we're really, really delighted. And so with that, so that's sort of beginning introduction. Maybe some other evenings I'll talk more about the place and the sort of whole concept, the mandala within which we are. Maybe when we meditate, I will introduce that. But for now, that's it. And now, Richard?
I was thinking that this text, Hatha Pradipika, which is commonly referred to as Hatha Yoga Pradipika. But the old manuscripts don't say Hatha Yoga Pradipika. They say Hatha Pradipika. It's a beautiful text in that it ties together all these different approaches. Probably composed around 1450. And so it's relatively modern. And I love it because it takes all these different angles and blends them together. So it's kind of a non-sectarian. It's, you know, Hatha Yoga is basically a Shaivite, it came more out of Shaivism, but it was also all these different groups practice it. They're, you know, early, you know, it's kind of the foundation of the early tantras, were people doing things related to Hatha Yoga. And so it's beautiful because the text specifically, perhaps to a fault, is saying, well, all of these names for this state called unmani, or the no-mind mind, they're really referring to the same thing. So get over your prejudice is basically what the text is saying. And this is very much in line with the basic, I think, the view of Advaita Vedanta, and I believe also the view of Nagarjuna,
Madhyamaka.
Madhyamaka. That once you get this experience, you know, the same experience comes clothed in all kinds of different schools and techniques. But once you get a taste for it, you get it. And so it's a famous book, and because it's accessible, and that's why I chose it.
Wonderful.
And that way...
Salutations to Adinata Shiva, who expounded the knowledge of Hatha Yoga, which is like a staircase leads the aspirant to the high pinnacle of Raja Yoga. Very good. Yeah, it actually really fits well with the five stages one.
Yeah.
Actually, which I said, which you have on your machine. Adinata. Adinata is so interesting because it's the same. Adinata would mean Vajradhara for the Buddhists. It would mean Vajradhara. Adinata means the primal protector Although, you know, I don't translate Nata as protector.
How do you translate it?
Savior.
Oh.
And my colleagues freak.
Yeah, it sounds very
Christian. Because that's Jesus.
Yeah.
It's only Jesus.
Well, that's the only, yeah.
But because Nata, you know, in all these traditions, they have these fierce deities who are the servants of the high supreme deities, who are, you know, fierce and they protect you from things, you know. But the Nata, the idea of Nata, is someone who protects your soul from the samsara. You know, so it truly is a savior, an intercessor, you know. Although in the Indian tradition, usually, except in extreme bhakti cases, they don't say that they can that savior can do the whole thing for you. You know what I mean? You have to do it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, India usually makes you do something. The Indian traditions. No, they do. They don't say you can bomb Iraq and then pray to Jesus and you'll be fine. They don't say that usually, the Indians. Usually. Maybe a few fanatic groups.
That's true. Yeah. It's only the extreme devotion. And this is Hatha Yoga. The Hatha Paradipika is from the Nath school, which was very dominant in Rajasthan, and what's the place south of Rajasthan?
You know, Maharashtra.
Maharashtra, Rajasthan, Udaipur, the Nath Munis. This is and so at one point, this was a group of yogis who their monasteries became very powerful. The king was a member, and so they had tremendous political power at a certain point. And it was a big time. And 15th century.
It's a wonderful thesis one of John's fellow students wrote. The tantric Brahmins, you know, who were maybe originally Brahmin, became more powerful, you know, socially than the regular Brahmins because they were not afraid of impurity and they could reach across caste lines, which the pure Brahmins couldn't do, you know. So they more like stayed aloof, you know. But the tantric ones, or the yogi types, were more important in that sense. I mean, he did a very interesting study of that. I was surprised. In Tibet, it's like that. Right?
Yeah. Because the whole idea of the Gita, of a Brahman, is someone who sees everyone equally. You know.
Well, that would be the ideal, yes.
So, yeah. And of course, that isn't the reality. But, and a footnote to that, that many people are not aware of, that Pattabhi Joyce, who is a Smarta Brahmin, meaning Smarta Brahmin are those in the lineage of Gaudapada and Shankaracharya, or Advaita Vedanta. They are also the holders of the main school of the Sri Vidya lineage. And so Pattabhi Joyce was a, I should say, closet, from our point of view, a closet practitioner of Sri Vidya Tantra.
Why was he closet from
you? He didn't tell anybody about it.
Oh.
Unless, he wouldn't tell you anything unless you twisted his arm. And because he was flexible, having done so much yoga, just twisting his arm like a normal person didn't do anything. You'd have to do like a triple twist, pin him down and trap him, and then he would tell you something.
I see.
And so, actually, he had that, you know, if you got to know him, he had that little tantric glimmer.
That I see.
Not afraid of impurity.
So Sri Vidya is a Vaishnavite type of tantra, you mean?
No.
Oh, no, Shiv Chaivite.
Yeah.
Oh, good.
It's Shaivite, okay. Yeah.
Okay.
But being a smarter Brahmin, so Shankaracharya, Gaudapada, they were Shaivites.
Mm-hmm.
But many of their texts they would dedicate to Vishnu. And because the very definition of a Smarta Brahman is someone who sees Vishnu and Shiva as being the heart of each other. That they're absolutely really the same thing.
Right.
Just
course.
A slightly different evolution of a metaphor.
Yes.
And they understood that thoroughly.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a huge leap of insight in kind of the provincial, you know, sectarian nature of India, where you go one village to another and they hate each, you know, one monastery, you go across the alley to another and you just hear the worst things about
really old Vaishnava and Shaiva.
Oh yeah, they're just so mean and just amazing.
Oh dear.
Well, seeing everyone equally.
Very important.
Yeah, so I like the idea of the tantrika Brahman, who isn't hung up on the idea of ritual purity and division.
Yes, there was the famous Luipa, who I think is the same as Matsyendranath, you know, in the Hindu lineage of siddhas, of tantrikas, yogis, siddhas, who he was, he met a yogini who was who was enlightened, a female and Buddha, and they had kind of this dialogue, and he was supposed to be very advanced, and then she said, "No, you still have this kind of aversion to impurity." So she prescribed him a diet of fish guts. Matsyendra, you know, the lord of fishes. So then he sat, and he, this is at least in the Buddhist version of the story, I don't know if that's also an Indian story, but for 12 years he had to eat only fish guts. And then this guy overcame his feeling of impurity, and then he achieved, you know, Mahasiddha status. You know, he achieved realization of non-duality. Full realization of non-duality, because if you have duality amongst what's pure and impure, very intensely grow up with that in your culture, then you can achieve non-duality. Realization of non-duality.
That's why for a Brahmin in India to do the Panchamakara, the five M's, is very intense. Whereas for someone like, for most of us, to do it is just a normal Friday night. To steal a joke from someone. And it doesn't really have the same power. So if you say you're a Jew and you know and you don't want to eat pork, it's definitely not kosher. And if somehow you wound up in a situation where you had to eat it, and you had to eat it slowly and mindfully, you know, it would be so intense.
Yes, that's right.
You know, but then just imagine, or somebody, if never eaten meat, and you had to, and you soon, you know, just touching it to your lips, your mind would focus, and you would have all of these physical reactions to it. It'd be fantastic. And who was it that had a thigh bone trumpet? That was that Roshi Joan? Yeah, some years ago.
She has one.
Yeah, but the first time I blew that human thigh bone trumpet, because I'd worked with cadavers, you know, in the lab, you know, that's like, you know, thrown body parts all around, but I'd never like touched it to my lips, you know. And that was quite intense, you know, to blow that, that thigh bone. Crossing these bounds.
It's used for the Jura ritual, you know. You know the Jura ritual, which means the severance ritual, you could call it. And that, in that ritual, you are summoning the ghouls and the demons and all the vampires from Hollywood, the werewolves and all that, whatever it is. And you summon them to a feast, which is yourself. And then you visualize that you become with them. Your skull is taken and put on a tripod, and then your body is, a dakini comes and chops your... I'm just kidding. Just being mean. So where were we? It's okay, so... Why don't you read the Sanskrit, and then I'll read the, your... Is this your translation?
No.
Oh, good. So when I complain...
Yeah.
After you. Not the you know, I'm a translator by profession, so I can't help myself to correcting words and changing terminology. It's really terrible.
Let me pull up a version with Sanskrit.
Why don't you read the Sanskrit, and then I'll read the, your is this your translation?
No.
Oh, good. So when I complain. I'm a translator by profession, so I can't help myself to correcting words and changing terminology. It's really terrible.
Let me pull up a version with Sanskrit.
The reason for that is that most translators in the past, you know, really philologically skilled ones, you know, linguistically skilled ones were academics, and they translated these things like they were museum curators looking at some odd thing that people weirdly thought or wrote in some other culture. And then there are some practitioner translators who are not skilled philologically, and they kind of do it free according to how they feel. So they're very rare that they combine strong, you know, linguistic knowledge and dedication to the practice and a belief that what they're translating is something, some kind of higher knowledge than the knowledge in our own culture. Do you know? Like, you can't get a degree in an academic thing just translating something. You have to write something about it, something new. But in ancient time, in Tibet, for example, a translator was considered incredibly honored, because by translating from Sanskrit, they were looking into a higher culture than the Tibetan culture, therefore they were elevating their culture. You follow me? So Americans who think we have the most smartest and the greatest and whatever, you know, we're just totally deluded. We think translating is just looking at some lower thing, but we're wrong. Right? Especially when we look at Deva Bhasha here. Okay, I'm sorry. Little side footnote. Onward.
Okay. Let's look at the third verse.
Okay. Third?
Third one.
Okay.
Brancha Bahumata Dvante Raja Yogam Ajanatam. Hatta Pradipikam Dhate Swatmarama Kripa Karaha.
That's nice. Yeah. Kripa Karaha.
Yeah, Kripa Karaha.
In the form of Kripa, compassion.
Yeah, out of compassion.
Owing to the darkness arising from the multiplicity of opinions, people are unable to know the Raja Yoga, the royal yoga. Compassionate Swatmarama, composes the Hatha Yoga Pradipika like a torch to dispel their darkness.
Yeah.
So can I ask you then, what is Raja Yoga?
Ask me.
If they can't know, yes.
Oh. So Raja means king or royal.
Yes.
It's the best yoga.
Mm-hmm.
And it's any yoga it's the completion of any of the different approaches to yoga.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's the realization of the nature of reality. It mm-hmm. can be defined according to your metaphysics, you've got to define mm-hmm. it. Let's see. One traditional Vedantic definition is that one realizes that Atman and Brahman are mm-hmm. the same.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely indivisible.
Mm-hmm.
But if you were a Buddhist, you would find that a bit awkward.
No, that's cool.
Oh, okay.
That's not a problem.
Cool. Okay. And then the state is described in the
spirit. We define maybe the Atman, the Brahma a tiny bit differently.
Okay.
But we should get into that. But Atman, it would be fine to use that language, actually.
Okay, yeah. I like Atman is just in normal Sanskrit the word for oneself.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you're just like I'm talking about me, myself, anything I'm referring to is me. And of course, then in Advaita Vedanta, what you're discovering is you, all of the things that are not you initially.
Uh-huh. You think you are all the things you are.
Yeah, like I'm not my fingernail, I'm not my body, I'm not my mind, I'm not any of the content of the mind, I'm not the mm-hmm. subtle intelligence, mm-hmm. I'm not the winds,
mm-hmm.
I'm not the pranas,
mm-hmm.
and all of the, well, who are you? Okay, well, keep looking. And
you are God?
Yeah, and what is that? It's not anything you think, it's not anything. And so Atman is the actual indefinable nature of, you know, even if you said anything, then you have to keep looking. Well, what is its actual? Atman is the actual, it's the actuality,
uh-huh.
the reality.
Right.
And what we discover is that Atman is empty of self.
Mm-hmm.
It has nothing, no matter how deeply you look, there's no ego, there's no self or anything separate there. But Atman turns out to be everything,
mm-hmm.
but not even everything. It's you.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And so when we say Atman, and everyone is doing yoga, I want to find my Atman. And it still has a local quality, you know, realize yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And then the word Brahman, which is a separate evolution in Indian philosophy, it's a Vedic term,
mm-hmm.
tends to mean that which expands, which its nature is like this holographic mm-hmm. endless expansion,
mm-hmm.
This interpenetration where you, it's this like this gigantic net.
Mm-hmm.
Every point of the net is the center of the net. But it's mm-hmm. lacking in a sense of local quality, local, you know, just an ordinary word you say Brahman, people think of this great ocean of light or something.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't think of specific things, you know, like
mm-hmm.
cheese and wine or whatever goes on locally in the Catskills. Okay. Whereas you say Atman, you know, you're thinking of like a little bit of more like, even though you're not these things, you're still thinking of, well, you know, personality, fear of death, oh, I can't overcame death. And so there's still this kind of subtle dualism philosophically between Atman
mm-hmm.
and Brahman.
Mm-hmm.
And so to realize that there's absolutely no difference at all is to understand. And this is something you realize rather than understanding intellectually.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And
can I do that from the Buddhist
sure.
side to get rid of the notion that there is this opposition, in the sense that the Buddhist side starts with anatman, the non-self, or no-self, or selflessness, we call it. And that's sort of where Richard, just as he rightly said, the paramatman, the supreme self, is the realization of your freedom from all of the things you thought we think we are ourselves, body, mind, speech, possessions, whatever, all of that. So there is this na-iti-na-iti process where no, neti-neti they call it, right? Where you're not this, you're not that, you're not the other, and then it turns out you are the ultimate, which is everything. So the Buddhists start right away with the anatman, and they say that what you are is lacking a self, meaning that all your relative selves are not absolute. So they're not really you. They're relatively you, but we wrongly tend to think that our relative identity is our real identity. As my old guru used to say, my Mongolian guru used to say, people are not wrong to think they're real. The problem is they think they're really real. In other words, we exaggerate, subconsciously, people think they're sort of absolute. That's why I like the irreducible me, do you know what I mean? And they have a self-identity that's irreducibly themselves. So the Vedanta way goes where you reject all the minor attributes, the relative attributes of self as being the real self. And when you come to the real self, you call that the supreme self, which actually has none of your individual characteristics. And therefore you say that supreme self is Brahma. The Buddhist way is you realize your selflessness, meaning that all of those sense of self is not you. And then emptiness, they call Brahma as an emptiness. The equivalent of Brahma is emptiness, which just means that it's empty of any personal fixed thing that you could relate to. So in a way, that's why it's shared, like everyone is Brahma, you know? In Shankara's, and in fact, Shankara's form of Advaita was unpalatable to the majority of Vedantins in India. He was actually accused, very soon, in Indian terms, very soon, a mere century or two after he wrote, even though they have Shankaracharyas there, he personally was accused of being Prachanabauda, which means a closet Buddhist. And the reason he was is that if you say that Brahma is nirguna, meaning unqualified, absolute, and in that sense shared, you know, when you realize you're Brahma, you realize everybody else is Brahma too. So you're actually not that special, in a way. Everybody is Brahma, you know what I mean? And everybody can realize they're Brahma, right? So that means that things like the caste system, the difference between the Brahmin, the Kshatriya, the Vaishya, and the Shudra, and the Chandala, that these are just relative human-made, man-made artifacts. There's nothing absolute about them. And actually the Chandala, the outcast, is Brahma too, is Nirguna Brahma. And when you realize that you are the outcast. evolving. So it's radical non-dualism. And this, they didn't like that. So they came up with what they call Vishishtadvaita, qualified non-duality. And then ultimately with a great philosopher, Indian philosopher called Madhva in the 16th century, in the 1500s, they came up with a brilliant Indian invention called Dvaita Advaita, which means dualistic non-duality.
Yeah. And dualistic non-duality preserves the specialness,
yes,
in Madhvacharya's case of Vishnu as the supreme God.
Right. Right.
In other words,
Sarguna Brahman.
There is this level called Brahman, but that's a lower off-sloughing of the,
right,
supreme Godhead, of the supreme deity.
Right.
Therefore, they maintain their specialness,
right,
their exclusivity, and their political and economic positions.
That's right.
Just like,
and they don't have to
look
wash
at
the most religions
do the
toilets.
Same thing.
Yeah. Right. And so that's why so that's why the Buddhas and Shankara are actually no problem, very very close. And the Buddhists and the Vishishtadvaitins or the Dvaitadvaitins, etc. And they're all the beautiful, sophisticated philosophical things. Every single one of them are the greatest philosophers that ever walked. Oh, they're incredible. Sanskrit is the greatest philosophical language. And they're just amazing. But the Buddhists and the Advaita, the real heavy-duty, radical Advaita Vedantins, were always in tension with them. Because radical non-dualism erodes, you know, absolutized hierarchies. And that is why in Tantra, which I believe is the source and very closely connected to Hatha Yoga, and as we will explore here and we'll discuss and we'll get Richard's view of that. But Tantric yogis have to do those five M's. And they have to do these things that many of them were brought up as Brahmins. And so then they have to eat meat, have to drink wine, and have to have sex. They have to, what's the other one? That's three. And madana, maitana, mamsa, and probably some mudra.
Drink wine.
Mudra. Urine and feces, I think. That's stuff like
that's
that.
That's not one of the.
No, no, they're supposed to eat feces and urine.
That's a different.
No, that's in, I think it's in the impure things.
Yeah.
Well, at least the Buddhists do that. That's okay. Because one shouldn't make a distinction between gold and shit. If one is really too non-dualistic. So, but of course, it's not nourishing to eat excrement. So therefore, it's only a matter of breaking the taboo.
It's breaking the taboo. Yeah.
But there was a siddha. Do you know the story? Did I tell you the story about the siddha in Benares that Alan Admiral told me?
No.
Well, there was a siddha, Hindu siddha. You know, like a not siddha probably, in Benares. There was a famous case in the 60s when this friend of mine, a great painter, perhaps, I hope he's still alive, but I haven't heard from him in years. Alan Atwell, great, great painter. And he was there, and he said there was this notorious case of this siddha who lived in a park in Benares in one of those sort of squares where they had restaurants and things and shops, you know. But he always hung out in that sort of park in the sort of central part there. And he would poop wherever he felt like it. And the merchants were upset because it was driving away middle class sort of, you know, cleanliness-oriented customers. So they had him up in court. And he didn't want a lawyer to represent him, you know, for creating public disorder or whatever he was doing. And he just sat there quietly. And they had all these witnesses about, well, he pooped in front of my restaurant, and he pooped in front of my jewel shop, and he pooped on in front of my ice cream stand. And they're really freaking out. And then finally they finished their prosecution. And my judge said to him, well, Baba, do you have anything to say in your defense? And he said, bring me a plate and a knife and fork, which they did, because they respect sadhus in India. And he took that plate and knife and fork, and he pooped right there in the courtroom, on the plate. And then he calmly proceeded to eat it. And he said, there's nothing impure here. And the judge said, case closed. And he was exonerated. Only in India, in the 60s. I don't think it was
in the 60s, yeah.
What?
Yeah, they've devolved since
then. I think they've devolved. But Alan Admiral used to tell that story with great relish, which I share. And he was not a Buddhist, he was a yogi.
Yeah.
It's because it's beyond this kind of Buddhist, non-Buddhist.
Greetings and salutations, podcast wallas. This is podcast producer Justin Stone Diaz, and I'd like to welcome you to this episode of the Bob Thurman Podcast. The first half of this podcast began with Bob describing the Medicine Buddha images which are inside the Nalanda Conference Center at Menlo Retreat and Dewa Spa in Phoenicia, New York. He then proceeded to introduce Richard Freeman and began a discussion on how the connections of Buddhism and yoga are found within several key texts that him and Richard brought with them. It was a back and forth between Sanskrit and Buddhist philosophy, and it got a little thick there, but in the end, Bob lightened things up with that very off-color joke and story. Sorry we didn't mention that there was explicit language. We did mark it in the podcast description itself. We ask for your forgiveness and a small apology to any younger listeners who weren't aware that this was an adult content episode. Small prayer to George Carlin, the Bodhisattva of naughty language. May he guide and protect this podcast and keep on inspiring us to push the edge. Now, for those of you who may have got a little lost in the first half of this podcast, don't worry. Bob brings it all together in the second half. And after the second half of the podcast, if you're still wanting to learn more, we're going to provide a free podcast extra, which will include the entire day's session. If you're inspired by what you hear here and want to learn more about Tibet House, Bob Thurman, Menlo Retreat, or specifically the Buddha and the Yogis programs, please visit tibethouse.us. There's links to the member archives and links to the Tibet House YouTube channel where many clips and full teachings from past Buddha and the Yogi teachings are available. To get full access to past recordings from Buddha and the Yogi programs and other Tibet House Menla programs, consider becoming a member of Tibet House US. Starting at $2 a month, we post weekly free videos and extended archives from all our past teachings. Distance shouldn't be a barrier to your access to these teachings. And please, if you'd like to support the Bob Thurman Podcast, please be sure to share, like, subscribe, and share on all your favorite social media platforms. Your online participation helps support the work of Robert Thurman, Tibet House US, and the Bob Thurman Podcast. And as always, the weekly interstitial music. It is provided by our dear friend Tenzing Chogyal. To learn more about Tenzing Chogyal, please visit his website at tenzingchogyal.com. And now, back to Bob and Richard in the second half of this week's episode.
Because it's beyond this kind of Buddhist non-Buddhist. In Sanskrit, there the Bauda, Prachanda Bauda, that word Bauda, secondary derivative of the word Buddha, they didn't use that word themselves, the Buddhists. They were Adhyatmikas or Nana or Bahyapas or something like that. The insider and outsider, they called themselves. Yeah. They didn't, there was no word for Buddhists versus non-Buddhists or something like that. You were inside some practice or you're outside, that's all. And at the Siddha level, there's absolutely no difference. They say there's no difference between Shiva, Vishnu, and Vajradhara, which is the yogic form of Buddha. Yeah. It's also blue.
Interesting, blue.
The dark blue is the ultimate reality color. Ultimate reality perfection color is a very dark blue-black.
Like a monsoon cloud.
Like a monsoon cloud. And they say it is the transmutation of the poison, the klesha, the addictive poison of hatred. So interesting. The most fierce of the poisons, hatred, is the one that, because hatred has a tends to destroy things, so it's the energy that destroys, the takes apart the facade of the samsara, of the structural world of suffering. It demolishes that world. And that's why I said, that's, at least that's a, it would be a Buddhist explanation of it.
Yeah. Well, Shiva has the blue throat.
Oh, he has hala, yeah.
From drinking. Or he didn't swallow it. He didn't drink it then.
He didn't?
Well, he only took it to here and held it in the Akash.
Okay.
Although he didn't spit it out, he didn't swallow it. But
he's totally cool.
Yeah. But he turned blue.
Right. Now they're absorbing the poison, but that connects to the Vaisvadeva, I'm sure. Absolutely.
So an
Shiva is a yogi. It actually interfered with his love life. Because Uma was not sure she really wanted to like snuggle up to some guy smeared with sedentary human bone ash with snakes in his hair and like blazing flame in his third eye. She used to have to, she would play strip poker with him or dice and win every time and make him take off the snake and wash.
Take the ash off.
Yes, she domesticated the mad yogi. She did. There's a wonderful poem. Kalidasa wrote a marvelous poem about it. It's really beautiful. It's a poem.
Another side note is the word Swatmarama. It's a beautiful name for the composer of the text. Because when you say Swatma, you're meaning the self of the self. Because swa is another reflexive pronoun that means self.
Right, his own self.
So it means the self of the self.
Right.
Now the self of myself, when I talking about myself, it's one thing, but if I start talking about the self of myself,
that's right.
Then you know I'm really
that's
talking.
That's the real self of the full self, right.
And Rama, it means the pleasure. So it's the pleasure of the self is the guy's name, Swatma Rama.
Right. Who else? I think this is Arama with a long meaning addressing pleasure. Swatma.
Oh yeah, Swatma. Atma knows wrong. Yeah, it could be either Arama or Rama.
So he's enjoying pleasure, in his own self, enjoying pleasure in his own self. Because, of course, the non-dual, Buddhist tantricas would say, yogis would say, that ultimate reality of Brahmahood, or near what they would call Nirvana, they could also call Nirvana, being blown away, that ultimate reality is not known by ordinary dualistic conceptual cognition. Or understanding, what we would normally think of understanding, it is known only by bliss. The subjectivity that knows that is that expansive, you know, ecstatic bliss which blows you out, kind of, you know. So it's not a matter of you clutch onto it, you give yourself to it through bliss. Mm-hmm. So the way they express that is that bliss is what knows it.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
Which is kind of nice. So Swatma, his own self, is bliss, actually.
His own self
is bliss. And he's enjoying the universe.
And out of his compassion, he dispels the darkness from Brancha Bahuma. And a Brancha means
erroneous.
Bad philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
Or bad views.
Mm-hmm.
And there are thousands and thousands, there are just endless numbers of bad views.
Mm-hmm.
And many of us entertain many thousands of them throughout the day.
Mm-hmm.
And these are just bad philosophies in which you're not really seeing reality.
Mm-hmm.
And so to dispel that, so not only is it referring to between the schools, which are always arguing with each other,
right?
You know, Iyengar yoga versus Ashtanga yoga, and it's like, give me a break, okay? And then Shia versus Sunni, you know, it's like,
right.
Same. So not only there, but amongst ourselves, and we're between our, you know, we make many theoretical selves throughout the day, many different points of view, and all of them are merely they're all context dependent, and they're all empty of any absolute position, and therefore, this will cut through that the light of Hatha Yoga, the Pradipa of yoga will cut right through that.
Mm-hmm. The lamp of it. Mm-hmm. Can I say something about compassionate? Since I mentioned bliss, in the sense that the non-dual realization is such that the person who realizes it achieves permanent, total bliss, right? But there's an awkward element in that bliss for the non-dualist, in the sense that they perceive their oneness with all beings complete. So therefore, while they feel blissful and they see all beings as blissful, they cannot ignore that most of the beings see themselves as not blissful, but are dissatisfied, they're suffering, they're held in darkness, and the key darkness is they think their separate self, their self that is separate from the universe, is real, is really real, and therefore they suffer. Right? Like me. I think I'm really real, I'm Bob Thurman, and I think you're all different than me, and you outnumber the hell out of me. And all other beings in the world outnumber me even more. So since and then there's the ticks. And there's the
billions
bacteria.
Of those. Yeah. What? There are billions of ticks and
billions.
Billions to the billionth power of bacteria.
Exactly. Exactly. So I'm freaked out and I'm suffering. I'm struggling with this other, which is the world, by my delusion of being myself separate from them, and that division is absolute. And there's only battle across the line, really. Sometimes there's friendliness. Mom liked me. You know, my lover liked me. My baby liked me. But it's for a while. All of that is for a while. But mostly everybody doesn't think as much of me as I think of myself. So I'm in conflict with the world in a way on a primal level. And even there are philosophies that say that's the way it is, you know, and you just have to, like, have nuclear weapons or something. But the non-dual person sees that, and yet they're frustrated by the fact that they cannot blast that suffering and that delusion out of the people and sort of bliss bomb them. Because the energy of that bliss, if they sort of just radiated it, the person who feels separate would feel invaded by it, overwhelmed by it, and they would tighten up even more, and they would become more freaked out. And they would crucify the blissful being, or waste them and somehow do them in, if they could, and if not, they would run away from them, or whatever. So that's where the compassion comes in. The compassion, we wrongly think that being compassionate is somehow to just climb into other people's misery. But that wouldn't help them, and that's not really compassion. That's just joining their suffering. Compassion is completely feeling their suffering and not feeling it at the same time, keeping the bliss so as to see, to act and engage in just such a way as to get them to rediscover that their suffering is actually bliss. You follow me? So therefore, the compassionate svatma arama, someone who's really self-enjoying himself, to compassion, meaning he's feeling that you're not self-enjoying yourself enough, as you should, and if you could, and as you will. So he writes a book, giving you some method to do that. Do you follow? So it's very important to note that genuine compassion requires that your duty, if you want to be a compassionate person, you have to be happy. Because you have to know what the happiness that the other person you're compassionate about is missing. Otherwise, it's like, oh, I'm so sorry for that person, but like I suck too, so we both suck. And I'm nice, so I say something nice. But it's nothing. It's not real compassion. It's some kind of wimpy pity, which then just leads you into more self-pity. Whereas compassion is a dynamic thing based on your happiness and realizing the other person could have, but they have to learn how to do it, and you then write a book. Okay? As he did. Is that all right? I just felt, because we were talking about bliss, and people get nervous about bliss.
They do.
It's illegal.
Well, you get guilty about it.
What?
It's guilt.
Yeah. Guilty, and then, but that's because it's illegal.
It's shameful.
Yeah, except in Colorado. They're okay, yep. Colorado.
And Washington.
State. And Washington.
Yeah.
And Oakland.
Oakland.
Downtown. Jerry Brown's hometown. Okay. So I just wanted to say that, okay? So he composes the Hatha Yoga Pradipika like a torch to dispel it, the darkness of unrealistic worldviews. And the worst unrealistic worldview that we all have here, just to let you know, where I'm coming from, and what is, it's one takeaway that we, it's the specialty of the house of Mehta. The idea that you will be nothing after you die. That is the disease of materialism / nihilism that probably all of you yogis are free of. But that is the worst of the false views, of the unrealistic views, the most dark of them. And even if we think we believe in reincarnation, we have to excavate in our subconscious about how we felt the last time we heard Richard Dawkins give a lecture or something, or some book, Sam Harris, you know, attacking religious people and things like that, and realize that we're brought up by science teachers to think that they have authority in saying that they know and they have discovered that the mind is an epiphenomenon of the brain, and that therefore you don't have a future life. When you just blow up your brain, you're nothing. And you, therefore you are essentially nothing right now. Because anybody could blow their brain right this second and they'd be nothing, according to them. But that's totally false. You're never going to be nothing, okay? You have the guarantee that's in Menla, Mountain Retreat stands behind you.
Big guarantee.
Big guarantee. None of us can ever be nothing. It's not possible. Okay, I'm sorry. Oh. Just because it mentioned the darkness of wrong views.
Yeah.
Okay. Now he gives a lineage. You want to do the lineage? I think we should pay homage to the lineage. But yeah. It's up to you. You're the guru on this.
Well, it starts out with Matsyendra and Goraksha. And mm-hmm. So both of these are very famous siddhas. And Goraksha has a whole lineage. And in fact, there's another book that's equivalent to this that is composed mm-hmm. by Goraksha. Goraksha mm-hmm. Samhita.
Some of these people, like Anand, Shavara, you know, these are the among the 80 siddhas, are they, of the Indian sort of tantrika yogic tradition?
A few of these I've heard of, and
Shavara is an important. The Buddhists have a set of what they call 84 great adepts or mahasiddhas, great attained ones, and Matsyendra and Shavara and Nata Nagarjuna, they call him as Nata, could be Nata. So it's up, they don't make a difference between Buddhism and Hinduism.
Yeah.
Goraknath, I'm not sure is in the Buddhist list. But probably is, but I don't recognize it right away.
Yeah.
And I sort of hear Siddhi Buddha.
Siddhi Buddha
is
could
that Buddha
be
himself they're claiming as
well?
I hope so.
Yeah.
It's nice. He'd be happy to be claimed.
Kantadi, Karantaka, Swarananda, Siddhipada, Charapati. Siddhipada could be a Buddhist. Kanera, Pujapada, Nityanatha, Niranjana, Kapila, Kapili, Vidunatha, Kang, Kaka, Chandishwara. So many. It's just like names and names.
Are any of these female, do we know?
Choli is a female.
Choli?
That's a... Bahuniki is feminine.
Could be. There's out of the 84 in Buddhism, they have a bad record. Only four. Are female of the 84. But about 60% of them have gurus who were female Dakinis or Yoginis or something. But somehow they don't get mentioned. They didn't write a book. They just shaped, you know, they made the guy eat fish guts and so on. I mean, they shaped them up. But they don't list them in the lineage except for four, which is wrong, which is bad.
Mm-hmm.
It's a residue of chauvinism, I think, in the culture.
Yeah.
Anyway.
So we can make up for that. Good.
So, but, you want to jump to nine?
Nine, let's see. Like a house protecting one from the heat of the sun? Or,
oh, no, that's a 10.
Ityadayo, Mahasiddhi Hatha Yoga.
Okay,
so these Mahasiddhas, breaking the scepter of death, are roaming in the universe. So this is
what's the Sanskrit word for scepter? Scepter, is it
here they have Kaladanda. Kaladanda means the stopping time.
Yes, it's the staff of time.
Yeah, which is better than the scepter of death is.
Yes, scepter.
Not in here.
The club of time. Right.
Yeah.
The Yama holds that.
Yeah, and so if you have that Kaladanda, Club of Time, or the Staff of Time. Yeah. So my, just in my mind, my image is that the Staff of Time stops time. But it's also the ultimate weapon that, you know, that these lords carry the ultimate weapon, which is time,
mm-hmm.
or patience.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you mm-hmm. know, Vishnu has his Sudarshan Chakra,
mm-hmm.
which he spins on his finger, and then, and it's like a boomerang, it comes right back to the finger, but it slices.
Right. And Yamaka is a club with a skull on the top.
Yeah.
Which brings death.
Yeah.
But they broke his scepter.
Yeah. And so what you do is the Sushumna, the central Sushumna mm-hmm. Nadi,
uh-huh.
is the call it, it breaks right. time.
Uh-huh.
Because once prana goes into the central channel, the chitta stops constructing time and space.
Uh-huh.
In other words, which is a construction. It's merely that.
Mm-hmm.
And so that construction of time and space stops.
Mm-hmm.
And so what does death mean?
Mm-hmm.
And you have that experience, the direct experience of that through this. So,
mm-hmm.
And then they say they're still roaming the universe.
Mm-hmm.
And so here we are. You know, probably a few of these are mentioned here in this list. Say whatever happened.
They're around.
Yeah, well, sure. They could be right here at the retreat, like Tintini.
It's not just Obi-Wan Kenobi who can appear in a luminous body. All these siddhas are there. Buddha is there for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Roaming the universe. And they're not really roaming idly, they're roaming to help beings. You know, they're traveling around.
So
but can you come back to Sushumna?
Sure.
So how does Sushumna? Oh yeah, that's the second question back in the early verse. Explains Hatha Yoga for the attainment of Raja Yoga.
Mm-hmm.
So then that requires in the second verse. So what is? How does Hatha Yoga form a basis of Raja Yoga then?
Okay, so
he's teaching Hatha Yoga to then attain Raja Yoga.
Right. So Hatha tends to mean. In a lot of the early texts, it means force. You know, like if you don't, if you don't just get this by hearing, you
mm-hmm.
know, that you know the nature of reality, then we got to get some exercises for you.
mm-hmm.
And have we got exercises for you? And so, and it's been explained esoterically in this that Ha stands for the sun and Ta. Palatal ta is the moon, and so these are two complementary opposites,
mm-hmm.
two ends of the same stick, and that it is a practice of one in the nadi system of taking the sun channel and the moon channel and
mm-hmm.
Balancing them so that
mm-hmm.
they are simultaneously open in the same way, and then shutting them off in order to open the central channel.
So the yoga, in a way, at the deep level, the yoga of the two is opening the central channel.
It's to open the central channel through
mm-hmm.
a dialogue between Ha and Ta.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so in our stage of practice, which is raw beginning,
mm-hmm.
it's finding the inhale in the exhale,
because mm-hmm.
they're complementary opposites,
mm-hmm.
or finding the counteraction in the primary action, or the finding the, what they call the pratipaksha kriya.
Uh-huh.
So pratipaksha bhavanam. And so in...
The antidote.
Yeah, in contemplation. Yeah, you start to look at something, you start to look at its pratipaksha, meaning its context or its other wing. Paksha
uh-huh.
is a wing.
Uh-huh.
And so when you get the both wings to work,
uh-huh.
then you get a synthesis between the two things.
Mm-hmm.
And that moment of synthesis stuns the mind because it no longer takes either path.
Mm-hmm.
And so the mind is stunned, it doesn't go anywhere, which is nowhere, which is the central channel.
Mm-hmm.
And so physically this manifests in the body as a central channel.
Mm-hmm.
And so all over the body in Hatha Yoga, we're discovering patterns of, you know, either sensation or flow, and then systematically creating the counteraction,
mm-hmm.
the other wing of it,
mm-hmm.
and then coming into a sattvic state or a contemplative state, or middle path state. And so you do that in the realm of the prana, in hatha yoga, through mudras and bandhas and pranayama. And then, hopefully, you can do that also philosophically, mm-hmm. which you start to understand conceptual systems as also empty, also as needing having context and balance. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so you start to have the same phenomena intellectually of the middle path.
Mm-hmm.
And in all of these, the mind hits what they call the unmani stage,
mm-hmm.
or no mind. In other words, mm-hmm. the prana stops moving, and it's just like, ah.
Bliss.
Bliss. Mm-hmm. And that's the middle path is, mm-hmm. is bliss. And so the Raja Yoga is the ah. It's the middle path.
Mm-hmm.
That's the king, and that's what mm-hmm. we're really talking about. And whatever technique you got to use, whatever you have to balance, might be slightly unique to you,
mm-hmm.
because you have individual circumstances
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
slightly unique.
Mm-hmm.
Usually, sure. We're not as unique as mm-hmm. we like to think we are. We're just slightly unique, you know.
Uh-huh. Well, significantly, but then the Hatha Yoga is unraveling the knots and the blocks of the central channel.
Yes.
And opening with which one then does the Raja Yoga?
Yeah.
It's open.
And so once your central channel opens, and you can taste the Raja Yoga anytime. In other words, the nature of the non-dualism is that any system, even in its plugged-up state of all knots and just being mm-hmm. on this lower level,
mm-hmm.
it is composed 100% of Brahman,
mm-hmm.
or it is already 100% shunyata,
mm-hmm.
bliss.
Clear light of
all, just as it's in mm-hmm. its actual immediate nature.
Uh-huh.
And you can realize the Raja Yoga at any
mm-hmm.
moment.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we all do. We get little hits momentarily.
Mm-hmm.
And so, for example, like in this text, it's not quite as clear. It's mentioned, but you can go into your central channel. You don't have to get into the bottom like we're working on, you know, to get the kundalini to
mm-hmm.
stop plugging it up. But you can go right in the executive entrance.
Uh-huh.
Right at the root of the palate, which is...
Uh-huh.
And you can do that anytime. In fact, you don't have to do it. The idea in Raja Yoga, and this is what makes it funny, is it's slightly beyond technique.
Mm-hmm.
It's, in other mm-hmm. words, it's insight into the very nature of technique
mm-hmm.
as being empty. You know, you don't even need it.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a joke or something.
well...
And it's something that we get little flashes of, I think, every uh-huh. time we like really connect with other people,
sure.
other beings, or two systems meet.
In the tantric physiology, yeah. in the Tibetan thing, when you yawn, actually, you get the central
practice.
Channel. You verge the prana toward the central channel. When you faint, when you fall asleep, you know, those things are all...
Exactly.
The reason you energize from a yawn is that your draw energy where it comes out of the central channel.
Thanks for tuning in. And if you want to hear more from the Buddha and the Yogis program, please visit tibethouse.us or tune in later this week as I post a special podcast extra, which will be the full raw recording from this day's event at Menla. And if you'd like to reach me, this is Justin Stone Diaz, and I can be reached on most social media platforms as Justin Stone, or you can email me. My email is justin@menla.org. Tashi Dilek, and thank you for tuning in.